Okay, so I am here with Nancy Cohen, who is most recently the author of Delirium, How the Sexual Counter-Revolution is Polarizing America. Nancy, how are you doing?
I'm great, Ed. Thanks for having me
Thanks for being here. Your timing is quite impeccable, because I'm talking with you the day after Representative Issa decided to basically not allow a woman to testify at the all-male hearing on contraception. I'm talking with you a week after Komen for the Cure initially pulled its funds from Planned Parenthood, saying, well, we can't support any organization that is under congressional review, and then changing it to be, well, we can't support any organization that is referring out its mammograms. So I got to say, maybe this might be the opportune time to discuss how we got to this point in American political history. I mean, you know, how does this constantly wavering excuse fit into the political strategy of the religious rights and the forces of what you identify as the sexual counter-revolution? Well, just how did this come into play?
Oh, well, I'm an evil genius, and when I came up with this idea a couple years ago, I planned for these hearings to take place this week. No, seriously, the first line of my first chapter is, perhaps if the pill hadn't been invented, American politics would have turned out very differently.
Yeah.
And at the time, it was kind of a literary allusion.
Yes.
You know, a way to get some history down. So what we're seeing is really the logical endpoint of what I call the sexual counter-revolution. Delirium tells a story about how a small group of reactionaries who want to control sex have hijacked American politics. And what we're seeing this week and last week is really the essence of the Republican Party, the id of the Republican Party coming out to play, because they are so intoxicated with the power that they got in the last elections.
Yes. Well, the id wasn't always there, as you point out in the book. I mean, it's sort of become increasingly id-like over the years.
Yes, no, 30, 40...
What of the sensible conservative idea? What of the rational reactionary?
The sensible conservative ideas back, you know, in the 60s and 70s, the Republican Party was the small government personal freedom party. They actually meant it. They were better on women's rights. They were better on sexual freedom, really. You know, even before the sexual revolution, the Republican Party was better. But what happened is, with the sexual revolution and feminism and gay rights, a group of people, surprisingly mostly women, were appalled, freaked out about all these changes in sexual life and women's roles and gays coming out of the closet. And they organized on a grassroots level against these changes. And so they went up against the Equal Rights Amendment.
Yeah.
And they won. And then they went after publicly financed childcare, and they won. And then they took civil rights away from gays, and they won. And then they methodically started taking over the Republican Party from local, state, and county committees onto the school board until 2008, when they had one of their own, Sarah Palin, on the presidential ticket.
Yes. Well, I mean, let's get into this. I mean, you point out that George McGovern is one of the key figures responsible for Democratic timidity in relation to the sexual counter-revolution. You suggest that McGovern losing his temper, telling a voter to kiss his ass, that was one factor. The really terrible decision he made involving, you know, ordering milk with a liver sandwich at a Jewish deli. Not exactly the smartest choice, but I mean, there was also this idea that McGovern, because he encompassed this cultural radicalism failed, that this was what encouraged the Democrats to backpedal. So, you know, I'm wondering, you know, to what degree is this political temperament, and to what degree is this, I suppose, a sort of cultural radicalism that Democrats are afraid of? I mean, you know, 2004, you have Howard Dean's famous scream, and even before that, you know, everybody was like, wow, this guy's finally standing up for progressivism. I mean, you know, it seems to me that if you have a situation where Democratic presidential candidates are limited in what they can say and how they can act, that kind of progressive idea of say, supporting something like the Equal Rights Amendment, you're almost not allowed to do that. So, you know, how did this state come to be, and what solutions do we have for the future?
Good question. So the sexual counter-revolution has affected both parties. And in the Democratic Party, it's really about their overreaction to every time they lose. And the way it goes back to McGovern's election is that they convince themselves that the reason McGovern lost by a landslide is because all of the gays and feminists and multiculturalists that he associated with himself with. And so this idea that Democratic progressives alienate mainstream America. Mainstream America is conservative. That idea is a fixation of the Democrats. But if you look at the studies of elections and you look at studies of public opinion, it's not true at all. Democrats have actually won elections for being the more culturally progressive party on women's issues and gay issues and race issues. And so Democrats, I believe, would actually do better if they did embrace their voters' live and let live attitude about people's personal lives and stood on principle for civil rights for every American. But Democrats are timid and they have convinced themselves that they lose on this issue. So
yeah.
It would be good for them to start to recognize that it's a winning issue.
What data are they using? It can't just be McGovern that's no, the linchpin
so what
for
they,
this.
What they generally look at is exit polls and focus groups. And to get a little wonky here.
Feel free.
What I looked at in the book, so that no one else really has to, except maybe Democratic strategists could start looking at this stuff, is a lot of research by political scientists and sociologists that do regressions of public opinion polling and elections, and conclusively show that all the things we think are true, you know, that the white working class man is an economic populist but a social conservative, wrong. It's the reverse. He's pro-choice and doesn't like the Democrats' economic policies.
Yeah.
That Bush won the election on gay marriage, wrong. No evidence.
Yeah.
That Democrats lose elections for being pro-choice, wrong. Clinton won the election in 1992 on a huge kind of upsurge of pro-choice women and pro-choice men.
You challenge Thomas Frank's ideas in What's the Matter with Kansas by sort of saying that he was condescending in believing that Kansans were duped into, you know, voting for more right-wing candidates and so forth. You know, how do we go ahead and factor in, say, scenarios like Scott Brown in Massachusetts, which is very much a scenario in which arrogance and technocratic approaches tend to destroy a Democratic seat. So, I mean, you know, how does this play into the sexual counter-revolution, and how do you reconcile this, what seems to me legitimate Thomas Frank idea, with this?
Well, so I do criticize for Tom Frank for being condescending, but I also criticize him for having no empirical evidence for his argument, and that's the main case. His idea is premised that, one, the working class doesn't vote for Democrats. They actually do. It's premised on the idea that Kansas has been some bulwark of Democratic politics. It's actually been a bulwark of right-wing evangelical fundamentalism. So there are a number of other factual errors. I actually went into the book assuming that I was going to extend Tom Frank's thesis.
Yeah.
And I found that it actually went back to this anti-McGovern idea and discovered that there was no evidence for it. And that's when I started moving in this other direction on the sexual counter-revolution. So an election like Scott Brown's, a lot of healthcare money went in there. A lot of the people that they say are white working class populist men are actually middle income or better off people. So what you have in a lot of these elections, like 2010 and the Scott Brown election, is you have very low turnout from core Democratic groups. Young people, single women, low income people. And so when the exit polls do show a surge of white men, they often don't figure out, well, where are these men economically?
Yeah.
And I do agree that the smugness of the Democratic candidate
we
in
don't
that
want to
election.
Name. And you did name in the book, and I won't name on this show.
Yes.
Traitor.
I think she's probably reformed.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean,
So I do think that that was a case of a sense of the Democrats being entitled to a seat and didn't really see this both right-wing and corporate money coming into the election that year.
If Tom Frank is so wrong with his evidence, then why is that book constantly cited? Why, over many decades, does the idea of the McGovernick still hold within the Democrats? I think that's the thing that I really, really don't get. If all of the scientific evidence says otherwise, then why are, you know, serious Democratic leaders basically going by this?
Well, actually, serious Democratic leaders aren't going by it anymore.
Uh-huh. It only took them several decades.
Yes, well, they read the polls, yeah, and they read exit polls, and they do their own political polling. They don't necessarily read the academic literature. But the key person who articulated this idea from the government about the Reagan Democrat, Stanley Greenberg.
Yeah.
You know, who I hear is a wonderful man and has done a lot of good work for progressive causes, was one of the people who kind of kept this idea alive. And he runs a polling company and he uses his own polls. That's fine. So just after, since 2008, he's basically said, you know what? The Reagan Democrats aren't the key voting bloc anymore.
Yeah.
Democrats need to go for this multi-ethnic, cosmopolitan, progressive base, and they'll pick up enough of these white working class men to win elections. So it is, though Tom Frank's, and I haven't read his new book, so I don't know how he's amended his thesis, but there has been a shift among the leadership of the Democratic Party. And I think you see with Obama not defending DOMA,
yeah,
right? Saying, I think it's unconstitutional. This is a sign that they're starting to see that good principles are good politics.
Yeah. But on the other hand, it is very strange that something like gay marriage is acceptable in degrees in this nation. You know, I mean, on one hand, you have Prop 8. On another hand, you have, in this state, among many others, gay marriage actually legalized. And so it seems to me that, I don't know, it seems to me that it's that what factors go into why gay marriage is accepted in one state and not in seemingly California, where you would expect gay marriage to pass?
Oh, they ran a terrible campaign, yeah, on Prop 8. And if they had run that a little differently at the time, it probably would have gone differently at the time. And it almost certainly would go differently now. So a lot of these things have to do with basic matters of campaigns and elections and how good you are at messaging. But leaving that aside, gay marriage is actually a really, really new issue. If you think about it, you know, we weren't talking about it before really 1999. I mean, you know, DOMA was earlier, but most people didn't know that this was an issue.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, you get things agitated among an activist community. So on the right, you have it on the anti-gay marriage side. And these are people who are also against gay adoption. They're also against civil unions. And they're using the newness of marriage as a wedge to try to bring more people to their side. They make people think, oh, we accept everything else. It's just marriage as a sacred institution.
It's more of a carrot.
That's bunk. That's bunk. If you actually read their constitutional amendment banning gay marriage,
yeah,
it will also effectively ban civil unions.
Yes.
Anyway, on the Democratic side, I think there was legitimate concern when it first came up. You know, this is really a new issue, and we can think it's going to be a winning issue. And
yes. And
it was radical. It's right, but it was radical when it came up. So we've had a lot of movement on it, given how little amount of time it's been there. And there is, all the polling is majority support, but a slim majority support.
Yeah.
That still begs the question of this being a fundamental matter of equal rights and whether these things should be put to a vote. I mean, when the Supreme Court outlawed laws against interracial marriage, only about 10% of Americans thought interracial marriage was okay.
Yeah.
You know, so when Christie says, Governor Christie says, oh, we're going to put this to a vote because that's fair, I just suggest that they look at the history of civil rights.
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, actually what you said here about the Democrats having problems with newness, I mean, it reinforces, you know, you point out again in the book that Howard Dean was one of the few people to embrace the internet, almost serving as a kind of precursor for what Obama did 4 years later. Is this part of the issue that really the Democrats are running scared in the face of the present? This is why they tend to backpedal when there are serious issues like, you know, women's issues and sexual rights and that sort of thing?
I think politicians by nature are cautious. That's the only way they can win elections in a country as diverse as ours. And when you put it that way, running afraid of the present, I would say, no, the Democrats are running into the present because the Republicans are running back to the 19th and the 14th and the 12th centuries. So I think the way they look at it is the real issues are the economic issues. The real issues are foreign affairs. And absolutely, those are real issues. But a lot of people's fundamental interests and opportunities in life get traded away when you say, we're just going to wait. You know, gays and lesbians, please just wait while we fix the economy. All right. Meanwhile, people are dying and they can't pass on their property.
Yeah.
They can't visit each other in the hospital. Their community doesn't recognize the validity of their unions. And so I think the Democrats' problem is more of the fear of we can't do everything at once, so let's only deal with the important things, and we're actually a little afraid that we'll turn off people we need if we embrace these women's issues and civil rights issues.
But it's also not just the Democrats. You bring up Reagan, of course, in this book, and the fact is that he nominated Sandra Day O'Connor. And, of course, the religious right wasn't especially happy with this. On the other hand, he went ahead and he didn't say anything about AIDS, really, until maybe 1987, and even then, mostly stayed silent about it. You know, the question I have, and the question that I suppose all of us have about Reagan, is whether he was deliberately anti-feminist, anti-sexual rights, or whether this is indicative of what you're talking about, that you're going to be put on hold even if you're dying while we go ahead and tackle what seems to be the current agenda. You know, how do you reconcile this with Reagan? I'm curious.
It works very differently in the Republican Party because it was at the time of Reagan's election that these women who first organized the religious right came into presidential party politics.
Yeah.
And Reagan understood that, and they made a huge difference for him in the primary against Herbert Walker Bush. So Reagan was always trying to appease the religious right. What he actually thought is hard to say. He doesn't appear to have been a very religious man himself.
Yeah.
But he was trying to appease them. He wouldn't go as far, though, as some of these later presidents would with them. He was able, you know, he's the one who came up with the metaphor of conservatism is a three-legged stool.
Yeah.
The economic conservatives, the neoconservative foreign policy wing, and the social conservatives. Right now, the two other legs have been chopped off, and the only thing holding up the Republican Party are the religious fundamentalists.
This also brings to mind how we can compartmentalize, you know, the sexual counter-revolution from these other concerns. I mean, you know, are we talking about two stools, I guess, to carry on the metaphor, or are we talking about something that is... Is there a theory of everything here, basically?
I'm not trying to do a theory of everything, because theories of everything never work.
Yeah.
Except maybe if you're some brilliant physicist.
Yes,
and
exactly,
I don't know enough to say whether they're theories
how
of everything.
How are these related, then? Yes. What's connected and what is separate?
Yes. So what happened also around the time of Reagan, late 70s, early 80s, is that the economic conservatives, the market fundamentalists, recognized that they did not have any voters that would vote them into office to eviscerate Social Security and eliminate clean air laws and things of the sort. And so they very cynically made a devil's bargain with this rising wing of religious fundamentalists, who, by the way, were people who hadn't been voting before.
Yeah.
Right? So that's part of the big change in the Republican Party. It wasn't so much a shift from Democrats to Republicans as, you know, millions of people who weren't voting before suddenly started voting specifically on these social issues. So they formed an alliance with them in the late 70s, early 80s, and they actually helped these people to organize and understand how to lobby and do politics and everything. But what happened somewhere in the 90s, you know, kind of the puppets that they had, you know, delegated became the masters over them. And so they started to have to concede more and more to these sexual fundamentalists. That really, we can't believe that these Wall Street guys who want no taxes really want birth control outlawed.
Yeah.
Yet they're supporting a political party that, if it gets into power, will actually open the door to that.
Well, I also want to talk to you about, just going back in time, we were mentioning the Equal Rights Amendment at the head of this, you know, the lovely Phyllis Schlafly. You know, she is the major right-wing force against it. But here's the thing. The ERA, even Gerald Ford, supported this. You have a situation where Carter gets into office. He's an ERA supporter. And then when you have this ongoing chorus of people who want it and who are protesting and so forth, he basically blames the feminists. And then he brings up his own personal, you know, his own religious views of abortion, even though he claims to be pro-abortion, and this essentially is almost a form of self-sabotage. I guess the question I have is, considering Carter, I'm wondering, you know, if it's political pragmatism or what he believes to be political pragmatism to woo, I suppose, the more conservative base or to woo any vote, because his approval rating is also plummeting as this is happening, and I'm wondering if the just the nature of politics gets in the way of actually taking a stand and not blowing the, you know, the feminists or whatnot, mm-hmm. not blowing your base along those lines. I mean, how do you reconcile this?
Well, Carter was the most conservative Democrat to have run in decades, and he is an evangelical on the social justice side, on the progressive side. And I think probably what happened is all of this was bubbling up while he was entering national politics, and it was happening on the local level and the state level. So I think in some ways he got blindsided by that. He assumed that evangelicals would support him, and he assumed that feminists would support him. And he was trying to bring them together and didn't realize that, you know, the feminists were not going to be satisfied with half measures. And did, I think, legitimately make the argument that reproductive rights is a core right in terms of women being able to have freedom in their lives and equal opportunity.
Yeah.
And he was personally opposed to abortion. So I think he was legitimately angered that the feminists would kind of blow his presidency, you know, kind of. He blamed them for this intense conflict without really realizing what the forces on the right that were organizing more generally. And I think he got caught in the crossfires on that.
To go back to Scott Brown, you were mentioning, well, you didn't mention them specifically, but in the book you mentioned the Tea Party Express, the $300,000 they put into the campaign, having the person on the payroll and so forth. Money, which also factors into, say, the Arkansas Project, in which they're trying to dig up dirt on Bill Clinton from years before, which, of course, is also the interesting case of David Brock and Blinded by the Right, his sort of I Got Duped by Them book. Interesting book.
Fascinating book.
How much does money really affect the voting bloc? I mean, you know, we're dealing with money that's going to influence, but at the same time, people do have personal choice and so forth. And I'm wondering if you could entirely blame it on money, or if some encouraging of certain sentiments that are there is also part of it as well.
Yeah. A lot of people are talking about I'm going to get around to answering this question,
sure.
But a lot of people are talking right now that we're seeing, you know, birth control hearings and all of this stuff coming out right now because the candidates have decided that the economy isn't a good issue for them. That's got it absolutely backwards.
Yeah.
So the base has always been really concerned about these social issues. They just didn't allow any Republican to get past the starting gate who didn't sign on to a very extreme agenda. You know, an agenda that even Sarah Palin 4 years ago wasn't willing to publicly admit that she supported, such as that abortion should be outlawed in cases of rape. So I think on the activist side, on the right, the money's helped, but it's not the money that's made the difference. It's the passion. It's this idea that American civilization is being destroyed by sex and by single women and by gay men. And they, when they say they want to take back America, they really do want to take back America. You know, they want to take it back to a time when being gay was illegal and abortion was illegal and birth control was illegal, but they are committed. And I personally don't think it matters how much money they have to organize. They are going to be there. They're a tiny minority, but a committed minority. The money in elections makes a difference in their alliance with very extreme market fundamentalists, right? I think they tend to be against government because they think government's going to impose sex education on them, and they're Protestant individualists. They feel that if you're virtuous, you do well in the market, and if you're poor, it's because you deserve it. But the extreme agenda and the tax cut agenda, that is the money guys, you know, sitting down with them and saying, okay, this is what we need and this is what you need. Money in advertising and that kind of stuff, say in the Scott Brown election, makes a fairly big difference in low turnout elections. And, you know, about maybe 30% of Americans pay really close attention to politics at all times. And so any election is about how much information the rest of that 70% get. And it's often, the elections are often at the margins, you know, in those, in that 10% of voters who don't really have very strong beliefs one way or another. And so that's part of what happened in the Scott Brown election. The other thing that happened in the Scott Brown election is, even though Massachusetts is a liberal state, it still has a lot of rural fundamentalists. And so what I argue in Delirium is that the Tea Party is really little more than a rebranding of the Christian right. That they were unpopular when Bush, you know, went out of office and they realized that they needed, you know, a makeover.
So the Tea Party is like a new name similar to the, you know, Christian Coalition Moral Majority. Just another sort of two-word term. Yeah.
50% of people who identify with the Tea Party identify with the religious right.
Yeah.
They are disproportionately anti-gay, anti-abortion. So, I mean, there are people who, there may be a few libertarians in it, but it's not a libertarian movement.
Okay. I have to bring up Hillary Clinton. I didn't mean to postpone her for so long, but you point out that there were many efforts, of course, to dismiss her, both with the, you know, with the 2008 election and also, you know, when she was a potential first lady. Gail Sheehy's Vanity Fair profile is one thing you bring up. She, of course, later did a book on Hillary, but it contains the sentence, "One can detect the calculation." None of this, of course, stopped women from voting for Bill Clinton. 54% of all women voted for Clinton in 1996. 56% of all women voted for Obama in 2008. So I'm wondering, do you feel that there would possibly be a more progressive push for women's issues if Hillary had won? I mean, how do you account for this discrepancy? I mean, I was talking earlier about Clinton possibly winning on the economy, but I'm wondering if we could sort of unpack this a little.
Yeah, I think if, in terms of the election and her campaign, I think if she had embraced the fact that she was a woman candidate earlier, she would have knocked the wind out of Obama's sails.
Yeah.
The irony is that she was laboring under this illusion that I talk about a lot in the book, that the secret to Democratic victory is through conservative white men.
Yeah.
So she deliberately downplayed her progressive views and the fact that she was a woman so that she could attract these men who are, you know, these mythical men, because there aren't a big number of voters out there.
The Margaret Thatcher strategy, you
Yes. Yes. Whereas Obama very smartly made that appeal to a progressive. Now, he downplayed the race issue. But we were at a moment when if you motivated young people to vote, that was the winning strategy, to embrace the progressivism. So actually, in the election, both of them were very solid on women's issues. And I do think Obama has been very solid on women's issues. I would just give him a B-plus, though, on the issues of reproductive rights and birth control and abortion. I think this is the one area, and also not coming out and saying that he supports gay marriage, is the area where he's showing timidity. And I, who knows, right? He's a bit of a mystery. I think he may actually share the a little bit more conservative beliefs on the abortion and reproductive rights issues. And I think he just doesn't want to go to the gay marriage issue. He's like, even if it's, I think his view is, even if it's a winning issue, why should I talk about it?
Well, I mean, in light of the fact that we have sort of a clown car of candidates on the Republican side, how is this going to have an effect on pushing the progressive issue, do you think, for Obama in 2012? Or is it sort of a moot point? I mean, you know, we'll see what happens, but I mean, it's a very strange race so far. And Santorum's actually winning primaries. I never thought I would see that.
No, I would have included much more of his craziness in the book if I thought he would still be a viable
candidate. You were prescient on that point.
I mean, he's there, but I was not prescient on that.
But what do you think this is going to do to the Democrats' ability to be more vocal about, you know, cultural progressivism?
Yes, I think with this current eruption of sexual politics, it plays to the Democrats' advantage, and they can also make it look like, well, it's not us that brought this up, but we have to defend it. I think it also motivates the base. And so I think whatever the Obama campaign was planning on doing, I don't think women will let him be quiet this year.
But, I mean, if you're a woman and you have a choice between, well, it could be Romney, if it's Santorum, my God, I don't think so. You know, if you have a choice between Republican candidate and Obama, and neither of them are really saying, I'm here for women's rights, you know, what do you do?
Well, let me say, Obama actually has been there for women's rights. There have been a lot of things under the radar, particularly on economic issues and work issues and health care, that he's been really good on. And I also think that women will look at the alternatives and say, you know, we've got to go there. You know, I don't think he should have gone with this compromise that he did last week. I don't think there's a legitimate religious liberty argument here, because the same argument, someone could say, I don't believe in paying minimum wage. My religion says I don't have to pay minimum wage, so you don't pay minimum wage. This is labor law, employment law. It's not about religious liberty. But anyway, it is a it was a compromise that preserved no copay birth control for women, even if they work for religious institutions. So if it holds, it's fine. The question is, if it doesn't hold, what's he going to do? I think he's seen that it's good to stand up for this, and it'll be a winning issue. But it's also important to note that there are a lot of right-wing women in this country, and that the religious right was organized by women, and a lot of the activists are women. So that's why you see women voting Democratic at the 55 to 60% level. But you don't see it at the 80% level.
I was going to actually ask you about that. I mean, how much of an effect is Sarah Palin or someone along those lines, who is considered to be a strange, almost feminist icon, or the conservative answer to feminism, you know, how does that affect, I suppose, this 40-some-odd percentage of voters? Can that actually be courted by the Democrats in any way? You know, I mean, you're almost damned if you do, damned if you don't. Because on one hand, if you're more outspoken about, you know,
cultural progressivism along these lines, you may not be able to court that 40-something odd percent, or that's the argument.
But so this is what all the studies show, that first of all, that 40% includes women that are just very fiscally conservative, that look the other way on the social issues. But when things get really bad, you get a higher percentage of women voting for Democrats than you would in a normal election where it isn't as prominent. There's no way for a Democrat ever anywhere to win over these really religious right voters. Every time the Democrats have tried it, even the exit polls show that they haven't picked up any of these religious voters. They don't pick up Orthodox Catholics, and they don't pick up evangelicals who define themselves as conservative.
Yeah. Then why do they still make a try every now and then if it doesn't work?
I think they get caught up in the echo chamber of the media, right? Remember after the 2004 election, oh, gay marriage, you lost on gay marriage. Oh, values voters. That was really quickly dispelled by pollsters and analysts of the polls, but Democrats stayed on that line for 3 years.
We should talk about Lieberman and the fact that, you know, he was the first Democrat to denounce Clinton over Monica Lewinsky from the Senate chamber. You know, he was followed, of course, by Kerry and Moynihan. I mean, what were their motives? Maybe this sort of gets into my last question of why the Democrats turn to the right occasionally along these lines to court these voters. Or was this really just sort of a way of getting back at Clinton for other things? What are your thoughts on this?
Well, for some of them, it was getting back at Clinton for other things. Like Moynihan, it was it was personal between he and Hillary over health care.
Yeah.
Lieberman wears his piety on his sleeve.
Yes.
He likes to thumb his nose at, you know, liberals and particularly secular people.
Yeah.
And so he wanted to say, I'm with the, you know, conservative American religious values on this. He thought at the time that he was actually doing the Democrats a favor.
Yeah.
My view of it from a historian, no.
Yeah.
No.
From a historian.
Just to be clear
on this.
From a historian's, no, because I wasn't.
As a journalist,
No, because a lot of this stuff I went back to come up with, you know, I didn't have the story when I was living through it.
Yeah.
And I actually think that stance contributed significantly to Gore losing the election. This idea that you have to run away from Clinton.
Yeah.
Even though his approval ratings were off the charts, they were like 60-70% approval rating. And so it did fit into this idea that Democrats have to be careful with the conservative American middle.
Yeah.
That conservative American middle that they imagine doesn't exist.
Yeah. Well, it was also considered to be the dullest national election. Gore won the popular vote. I mean, it really came. I mean, aside from the Florida situation, what could have been done to, you know, for Gore to carry more voters or for Gore to win more voters?
Yeah. Well, I go through this in the book and talk about how there was very low turnout among youth.
Yes.
There were critical states where he could have picked up the electoral votes that he lost in Florida by Clinton making an appearance there. But he ordered Clinton not to go on the campaign trail.
Yeah.
And even when other Democratic candidates asked for Clinton to come out, Gore said, no, you can't go. So there was very low turnout on the Democratic side. And it was also that he ran a very centrist campaign. And running a very centrist campaign is what opened up the space for Ralph Nader to take the most progressive voters in the Democratic Party on what turned out to be a very wrong notion that there was no difference between the parties.
Yeah.
But Gore did not provide enough in his campaigning to really convince people that there was a significant difference. And Bush ran a stealth campaign where he hid how conservative he was and hid his relationship, his very deep relationship, to the sexual fundamentalists of the Christian right.
2000, McCain, he denounces Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell. He calls them agents of intolerance. So, as we've just said, this allowed George Bush to sneak in and grab the Christian conservatives. So,
The question is, you know, he had to change his tune when he ran in 2008, and he had to actually court this particular vote. So there seems to be an idea from both parties that these votes matter. How much do they really matter, the sexual fundamentalists? I mean, are they really, if they're not so numerous, why is this always the issue every election?
There are two different groups of voters we're talking about.
Yeah.
In the Republican Party, the far-right sexual fundamentalists make up about 40 to 50% of Republican voters in most states. A little bit less in New England. But, you know, in the South, they might be 60%. Midwest, they might be 40, 50%. So since 2000, at least 40% of the vote for a Republican candidate has come from these far-right Christian conservatives. The voters that the Democrats are really aiming for are not activists. They're people that they think are conservative on gay rights and conservative on abortion. And so when they're soft-pedaling their progressive views, they're trying to get what they think the middle voter is, the centrist voter. Now, all the evidence is the centrist voter has actually become fairly centrist, center-right on economic issues, but center-left on the social issues.
Yeah.
Whereas Democrats think it's the reverse, that they're center-right on social and center-left on economics.
Yeah. How do you think the notion of the centrist voter, or even, you know, voter turnout in 2012? I mean, that I think is the key thing. If people believe this year that it's not much of a race, or that Obama has the bag, we could see a replay of previous elections. I mean, are there any early signs right now that you could cite that would, you know, that in terms of things that might play out in November?
Good point. If the Republicans had played their cards right this year, they would have done the Bush rope-a-dope strategy. Pretend to be a moderate, a.k.a. Mitt Romney.
Yes.
All about the economy, all about things, not about the social issues. I'm not running for pastor-in-chief. And they would be confident that the far right in the base would turn out because they despise Obama for so many reasons.
Yeah.
The problem is the far right pushed the Republican Party to overreach,
yeah,
and be extreme, and to be very public about it.
Yeah.
So I think if Romney had wrapped up the nomination early, we would have seen a low turnout election with this danger of everybody thinking Romney was kind of okay. Romney is actually extremely conservative.
Yeah.
He will be no different than Santorum.
Yeah.
He won't be as censorious, but he'll do the same thing. But now, by almost losing the nomination to Fitz Gingrich and Santorum, Romney has had to be very public about the fact that he's made these promises to the far right. And I think his personal life lends him that way. The Mormonism, the extreme conservatism on sex and women's issues in Mormonism,
yeah,
is something that Romney apparently wholeheartedly embraces. The danger right now is that this craziness that we're seeing right now, which will drive voters into the Democratic camp, the danger is that it dies out and the Republicans start acting kind of semi-sane.
Yeah.
And people forget that this happened. Right? Because what are we? We're 8 months out?
Yeah.
Is a long time in American elections.
Yeah.
So it's going to be Obama's job to make sure he has high turnout and reminds people of, as you put it, the clown car of the Republican candidates this year.
And where do women's rights go in 2013? I mean, you know, if this is really the issue, it seems to me that, as I was suggesting earlier, that really there isn't a place for women, at least at the time being, because of just this is just a very loopy election.
Oh, I think there's a place for women with Obama. I think he'll stand up for women's rights. And I think if the Democrats take back the House, we can roll back some of this crazy legislation that they've tried to get through, and we won't have further erosion of women's rights. It will be very, very bad if a Republican wins. And it's looking like there are enough women's groups and activists out there now who realize this, and the Republicans are doing enough to make what the women's groups are saying about them makes sense, that I think there will be there'll be a reaction, a pro women's rights reaction against the Republicans.
Got it. Okay. Well, on that note, I think this is a very interesting conversation. Nancy, thanks so much. It was a pleasure to chat.
Great chatting with you, Ed. Thanks.
Take your silver spoon, dig your grave.